Science Talk, the podcast about open science. My name is Per Pipinaspos. I'm joined today by Katie Smart, a colleague from UIT's University Library. Welcome to the podcast, Katie.
Thank you, Per.
So you've been working here for 3 years and a couple of months, and now you're leaving.
I am leaving.
You came from the researcher side, and you're going back to research after this. So I thought I would like to hear from you some of the experiences that you've had during your stay here at UIT. But first, where do you come from?
I am originally from Canada. I did my PhD in Canada about 15 years ago, I guess now. Now I feel quite old. Before moving to Germany for a Humboldt postdoc and then ultimately taking up an academic position in South Africa for nearly 10 years. And then I came to Norway and joined the library.
Right. So you've been on three continents and most of the time as an adult academic, so to speak, you've been on the researcher's side. And one of the things that I've learned from you is to always have the researcher's perspective when we try and make services for open science, which is what we do here at our university library and many, many university libraries across the world these days. I thought I would like to hear first from you about this Open Access Week, which is a digital event taking place in Norway each autumn. 1 week of webinars, and you took over for a while as the chair of this. What was important there in the Open Access Week in order to have that work?
Well, I would recall, Per, that actually you said I would find it interesting. So, yes, I was a very willing participant to take it over. And from what I understood, it was basically a series of webinars that would span out over a week across Norway from different libraries and institutions that would discuss current issues in like open access publishing and data publishing. And looking at the previous year's talks, it became immediately obvious that it was very insular. It was sort of like librarians and open science people talking to each other, but not really talking to the crowd that needs to hear it, which is like the scientists, the researchers, the academic staff who actually are the ones who publish manuscripts and create lots of data. So it was a bit of a difficult endeavor, but I was the hope was to create sessions that would be interesting not only to people who work at libraries and are passionate about open science and publishing research data openly, but also to the researchers who are taking part in this open science movement. So the first year was maybe less successful, but by the second year, I think we were targeting our audience, both audiences, a bit better, I think, with having talks about, I think one title of one session was particularly good, translated to English, was Bad Guys in Open Science, like basically talking about publishers who are maybe not fully coming to the table, which I think sparked some interest amongst the researcher crowd as well.
Yeah, you used the word enthusiasts when we talked about this before we went into this recording studio. You can't expect all researchers to be enthusiasts, can you?
No, absolutely not. Coming from a researcher, when I first joined the library, it's like I was coming to the open science religion, and everyone here was sort of, you know, worshiping at the altar of open science and saying how good it is, all the things you can do. And it is good, open science is good, but not really recognizing that every open science practice that one wants to do, be it archiving data openly or creating a preprint or working in an electronic lab notebook that's open, it all takes time. And researchers don't necessarily have extra time to do these things. So it's important to acknowledge that people might want to participate, researchers might want to participate in open science or open access practices, but the reality is they may not have the capacity to do so, and it may be not high enough up on their priority list. They may not recognize an immediate benefit.
One of the things that you've been doing is curation of data sets, and this is a word that I think most researchers don't know. They have no clue what is curation of a data set, but you know from the inside.
Yes, I know. So if you have a data set, let's say you've written a paper and there's like a table one full of values. In the olden days, like 5 years ago, you'd put that table of values just as a table in your PDF, like as part of the PDF of your publication, or maybe you'd have it in a supplement, and that would be good enough. But now a lot of journals, and if you're writing a thesis, they would like to have that, the publishers might like to have that data archived or deposited on another website, on a, like a repository that's openly available. So people, instead of, you know, manually typing in the values from the table published in your journal, they can just click the link, boom, get your table of values, and away they go. So when we get a data set like that, if you want to publish it openly and fairly, and I bet you this will be a nice segue to talk about the FAIR principles, if people want to make their data really open and accessible to people, you can't just dump in your data. It has to be looked at and evaluated to make sure it can be fully understandable and reused by the community. And that's what we mean by curation. We basically make sure you've added in enough metadata, like data about your data, and that your file formats are right, and you've chosen a license, and you've, you know, basically ticked all the boxes. So we look at your data set and make sure it's good to do. It's like a mini review process for your data set, and that's called curation. And it can be very easy and straightforward if the depositor has put some work into their data, or it can be quite a lot of work if we've just been sort of handed just one table of data with no explanations around it.
Yeah, because you need explanations, don't you? You need to in order for it to be reusable to others. But what's in it for the individual researcher? You call it depositor. I guess that's the researcher submitting the data set, yeah.
What's in it for them? I'm sure they'd like to know that too. Well, there's a lot of things in it for them. First of all, they may have to do it. So some journals these days, they have a data policy, and that data policy says, hey, you want to publish here? Fabulous. You better put your data in an external archive with a DOI link. Otherwise, we're not going to take your paper. So they might have to do it. All right? So that's one thing. They also may think, how many times have I sat in front of my computer screen looking at a published paper, and I want to use their values that they've published, but since I can't easily extract them, I have to sit here and type out all the numbers into my own Excel sheet. So if I make my data available in an external data set, which I can just click a link and grab the data, it makes it so easy for people to use my data again. I don't have to sit in front of my computer and go type, 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 type. So that makes my data easier for people to reuse and work with, which if you're sort of thinking about your citations, that might increase your citations and your work being more well known. You also may work for an institution here, like at UIT, where you actually have to make your data externally available on a repository, if it's possible. So what's in it for you? Well, it's just nice, first of all. You may have to do it because of a stipulation by the publisher. And if you think it's really nice to share data openly and make it easier for your community to use your data, then you'll want to do it just to, you know, play fair with the community.
Speaking of community, we also need to meet each other, don't we? Another thing that you've been involved is to try and convene with the librarians on one side, the IT department, and to meet then the researchers, the UIT Data Days.
UIT Data Days. UIT Data Days was born from frustration with finding a way to effectively communicate how to practice open science and handle research data nicely, how to effectively communicate that with the research community here at UIT. Previously, I think probably born out of COVID, we had these Zoom webinars, which were horrifically boring, black screens of death. So Data Days, we wanted to treat it like a conference. You come to a conference, you know, you get some free coffee and some cake, and then you learn something cool. So we tried to market Data Days as a place where you could come for one day, come for all, come for some, learn something about open science and handling research data, learn some good tools, meet the people who you want to meet so you know who to contact if you have problems in the future. And instead of using sort of open science speak or research data speak, like, you know, how to archive your data on a repository, we tried to use titles and keywords that were more catchy to researchers, like, need a DOI for your data? Come get one. Messy data? I'll show you how to clean it. Do you have to write a DMP because your grant says so? Come on in and we'll tell you how to do it. So we tried to market in a way that researchers might be like, yeah, actually, I have to do that. Cool, I'll go learn how to do that. So that was Data Days. It was sort of this mini working conference, I guess you could call it.
And how was it received?
I think the first time we ran it was last year, and it was good. We had really good response. We had maybe upwards of 50 people attending, and they were anywhere from PhDs, postdocs, professors, technical staff, engineers. We had a whole wide range of people, which was great. And people were actively working in our sessions because the sessions were built as like sort of mini lectures and then followed by active working. So you'd actually get to work on your problems. You could walk away with something done. And I think it was really well received. We had lots of networking and communicating happening at the lunchtime. And that was really great. The second time we ran it was also very good. Lots of personal connections were made. And I think it's well received. People who want to get something out of it will definitely get something out of it.
I know some institutions internationally, they have a system of open science ambassadors that they nominate some members of faculty of the different disciplines to go out there and be the go-to person. Database doesn't really, is not rigged that way.
We don't have that yet. That's something behind the scenes we were trying to do, is to think about getting members of the academic community here at UIT to come and say, this has been my experience with open science and this is why it's worked for me. It's hard to identify those people. We can identify them in-house. I mean, Per, you gave a poster about how it worked for you in your role as an academic. But it's been difficult to as yet identify those champions, so to speak. But I think that would be very powerful if we could get open science champions from science, from social sciences and whatnot to say, look, guys, this is what I've done. This is how it's worked. It's been great. You know, here's like a use case of how it can work for you too. And hopefully that will be the way of the future.
But you need, whether you call them ambassadors or missionaries, or you need to have someone who can speak to the community with credibility.
Yes.
And your background is in geology. Mine is in humanities, philology in particular. So, I mean, I can't easily go to your department and speak to your folks.
No.
So do you have some reflections on that, how a university library ideally should be rigged to have a good communication?
It's a really hard question. I think it's important for university library to first of all appreciate the researcher's perspective, which is something I've been beating the drum for a while. And I think it's important to have people employed at a university library who have that publication background and understand, so they can really effectively communicate with researchers, so they can say, yeah, I know this could be a bit of a pain, but here, this is important. But you don't always have the luxury of having people at the library who have that experience or significant experience. So I think it's important, as best you can, to look at who is depositing data sets, for instance, and contact them and say, hey, you've used our services a few times. Would you like to talk about it? And it's hard sometimes because, again, you're asking more from the academics who, again, don't have unlimited amounts of time. So I think that is the struggle. If you don't have a well-known open science champion who is an academic, it's hard to identify them. But I think they can be a very powerful tool if you can. So I know that I've had success personally talking to my own researchers in the departments I've sort of been responsible for, because I do have an academic background and I know what they find important and what they find cumbersome. And I sort of have a way to cut to the chase and say, look, this is what you have to do, and you're going to benefit from it. And I have had feedback. I mean, I've had several difficult customers, let's call them, from the academic environment, who have really struggled with how much work it takes to do open science. But I've had feedback from several of them saying, you know what, the editor of the journal where I've deposited or I submitted my paper, they commented how nice my data set was, and now I understand why we want to do it like this. So to me, that's showing progress.
Yeah, another anecdote from my side, I've heard of people trying to become professor. You need to submit all your work, and with this research assessment reforms, the committee actually said this person deserves to become a professor because they had published data sets as well as traditional publications, and that was a positive thing, and it showed that this person was at the cutting edge of research development in their field. So this can actually work, can it?
Yeah, it can, absolutely. And that's a really positive thing to hear. I think that's something that, like, our colleagues here at the library would say, is that the way that researchers are assessed also needs to change, not just by their age factor, how many citations they have, or how many publications they have. I mean, that's all important too, of course. And most academics would say that's extremely important. But it's also important to assess how much this person is doing in open science practices, depositing data sets, which are publications. They have a DOI. They can be cited. So they if they could be worked into the metrics, that would be extremely beneficial, I think.
Another thing that many university libraries are engaged in, of course, is teaching and courses. I know you've been involved in the data stewardship course. Could you tell us something about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, you'll correct me when I'm wrong, because I never get the details right, but it's a sort of an open education course. So it was developed here at UIT in the library by several of our colleagues, and it's a three-part course. It's called Data Stewardship, and it wants to build transferable skills so that even if you're getting a PhD in bioinformatics or social sciences or linguistics, you learn some common skills in research data management. So that at the end of your PhD, okay, you're very hyper-specialized in something very fancy, but you also have really good skills on how to handle research data. So there's three parts to it. There's one which is an online module where you basically learn the practicalities of research data management. There's a second module where we do group work together in person for about a week. And that's what I've been heavily involved in. And the third part is we send you out into the world and you basically do a baby internship at a non-academic partner to sort of become a data manager for a few days. So by the end of that course, you've learned some solid skills in research data management, but really importantly, research data management of not your own data, of data that's being used by someone else. So you gain some really good skills. So if you don't end up going into academia or working in the university environment, you could go and work for a company and be their data manager.
Yeah, we're talking about the DocEnhance project, which has developed a data stewardship course. You said first they take an online module, then they have about a week of workshops with librarians. Yeah. How has that planned out?
So we basically set up a week and we have sessions, about five sessions, and each session has a theme. Like, for instance, on one session we might talk about data management plans, how to write them, how to evaluate them, what makes a good one, which makes a bad one. We might have a session on how to archive your data, like what information do you need to archive your data in a fair manner. Including things like a README file, correct metadata, thinking about licenses. So we have these targeted sessions, and we have sort of problems that they have to solve, or they actually might try to archive some data and see what data they actually have to physically enter into a database before they can proceed to depositing anything. So it's really hands-on. But importantly, it's like we all handle data as researchers. But now when you have to handle data for somebody else, then you have to really think about clarity and reusability. And that's what the course is really great at. We've just been marking the exams actually this morning, and it's really nice to see the reflections from the students who say, you know, handling my own messy data and bad file structure is one thing, but handling it for someone else really makes me appreciate how important it is.
So that's after the third module?
Yes, when they've been with a company for a few days.
Right. Who are these typical course participants?
Generally PhD students, although we do have postdocs now and again. They come from everywhere. Biological sciences, geological sciences, linguistics, informatics, you name it, we've had them. So we get everybody. People who may not have much quantitative data, maybe they deal with pictures or videos or audio recordings, to people who are hired scientists with Excel spreadsheets full of numbers. So we get everybody. So it's really interesting to hear the different perspectives.
You said age is a factor. So these are usually what they call junior researchers or early career researchers. Mm. How would you say for a university library doing this outreach thing in open science? Anything particular to think about depending on academic age group you're targeting?
Yeah, okay. This is really important actually, because so you have the, as you say, early career scientists. So these are the ones who are PhDs and maybe postdocs who are relatively younger academically, and they're more open to new ideas, and they understand, they're more malleable. They can understand the importance of open science much more easily, and they know that they need to prove open science practices to, you know, get a EU funding granted, for instance. And also they're always in for the free lunch at these events, so they're there. They are there for it. And so we often speak a lot to PhD students, for sure. The harder part with sort of trying to show academics the importance of open science is talking to the older academics, and I will include myself in this group because I've been around for a little while now. These are people who have grown up academically, publishing with traditional publishing houses, you know, reviewing for publishing houses, only paying a page charge if the journal demands it, maybe paying for open access. But those are the people who have not been exposed as much to this open science system and are potentially a little bit suspicious of it. Like, share my data openly, my God, someone's going to take it. Or you want me to give a preprint? Why should I do that? Someone will take my idea and steal it. They're a little bit more, and this is myself, I include myself in this, they're a little bit more reluctant. I mean, they obviously, no one's going to say, ooh, publishing open is bad. Of course we want to share your science as wide as you can, you know, to be generous, but also maybe just to get a bigger readership, of course. But to convince them to spend the time to commit to these open science practices, that's harder. But one would hope that if their students and their postdocs are sort of bringing this knowledge back to them, it may be become more of a happy practice. They may be happier to do it. But certainly, we really want to target sort of the established, let's call them established academics, to sort of come over to the open science side, or at least consider it.
I would like to thank you now towards the end of our podcast for the efforts that you made for 3 years here. You've certainly put a mark on our local university library. Are there any further thoughts, some take-home message that you want to give us before you move on to the next stage in your academic career?
I think that we've come a little ways in the time I've been here. And I don't want to say, oh, I did so well, I helped us do all these things. But I think it's important to realize, and the university library is essentially a service provider. We're providing services to academics. And I think I hope what I've tried to do is to show us that that's great that we're providing the services, but you have to make the other people want the services. So you have to, it's basically marketing. You have to market and appreciate the customer, who is the academic here, and appreciate that, you know, their time is limited. I mean, everybody's time is limited, but their time, their capacity for improving their open science practices is limited. So we want to make it, we want to show them the benefit of it, which in general will benefit open science overall.
Thank you, Katie Smart, for coming to the podcast.
You're welcome, Per. Thanks for having me.
Open Science Talk is produced by the University Library of UIT, the Arctic University of Norway. Thanks for listening.